So welcome to MoMA. Thank you so much for spending the lunch hour with us. I'm Veronica Roberts, and I work in the Department of Painting and Sculpture. And today I'm going to be talking about Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo in New York City, why they came here, what they thought of Manhattan, and how Manhattan shaped their careers. While many of you may be familiar with, of course, the big Rockefeller mural debacle at, big Diego Rivera debacle at Rockefeller Center in 1933 and 34, I'm also going to be talking today about really interesting moments in Rivera and Kahlo's career that you may be less familiar with. For example, how many of you knew that in 1931, the Museum of Modern Art gave Diego Rivera a major retrospective, making him the second artist ever in the museum's history to have a huge retrospective show at this museum, second only to Henri Matisse. And then also in 1938, Frida Kahlo had her first solo show in this country, not in Mexico City. Her first solo show was here. She didn't have a solo show in Mexico till shortly before she died. Her first solo show was here at a really prestigious gallery just down the block on 57th Street. It's no longer around, but I'll be talking about that today. So really, in many ways, New York was critical to both of their careers. And since we have the privilege of being in this museum, I thought we'd focus on that moment, this city and their history here. But before we begin, I wanted to mention a few things. There you see some photos of them in New York. Rivera looking a little goofy on the left. But before we begin, I wanted to mention that the subject for this talk really grew out of, I work closely with the collection, and it really grew out of installing a gallery dedicated to Mexican modern artists that's on view right now on the fifth floor in our painting and sculpture galleries, just off of the Surrealism Gallery. So if you haven't seen the space since May when we reinstalled it, go after lunch or the next time you're here. We have an entire gallery. All of our Frida Kahlos are actually on view right now. One just came back from loan. So now's sort of an ideal moment to see the work, not only of the artists that I'll be talking about today, but also people like Rufino Tamayo, Jose Clemente Orozco, and other key people of this moment. And in addition, if you're interested in Mexican art more broadly, I just wanted to mention that there's a wonderful exhibition right now at El Museo del Barrio up on 104th. It was closed for a while. It's a museum on 104th I think 5th Avenue. And they have an exhibition dedicated what it's called Nexus. And it's looking at Latin American artists who came to the United States before World War II. And it's fascinating. In fact, our sketch that we have, our drawing for the Rockefeller Center mural by Rivera, is at that show right now. And that's up till February 28th. It's a short month, though, so that means you have to get there soon. And lastly, before I begin, I'd also encourage you to come to next week's Brown Bag talk on Monday or Thursday. My colleague, Paulina Paboja, who's also in painting and sculpture and who worked very, very closely with Gabriel Orozco on his show, no relation to Jose Clemente, but they are both Mexican, obviously. And he is a contemporary living artist who has a show here up on the sixth floor in our special exhibition gallery. So if you're interested in seeing where Mexican art has gone in the 80 or so years since then, come back and hear her. All right, so Rivera and Kahlo were just among pretty much every major Mexican modern artist in the 1930s made it to New York. So they were of the big three, or Los Tres Grandes, as they were known, the big muralists, which is Rivera, Jose Clemente, Orozco, and Siqueiros. It was actually Orozco who came to the United States first, mainly in search of money, since it was so hard to survive on the mural commissions that people were getting in Mexico City. So he was the first, but all three of them lived in New York, and Kahlo, who's obviously not a muralist, but all three of them and Kahlo lived in New York for significant stretches of time. Orozco, his biggest stretch was 1927 to 1934. He was here for 7 years. And Siqueiros in 1936 had this amazing brief moment of real productivity, a sort of a peak of his career when he's doing the experimental art workshop in New York. And of course, Rivera. And Rivera, New York was not the first place that he came. It was San Francisco, actually, where he did his very first murals. But in 1931, on November 13th, which was his 45th birthday, or his saint's day, he arrived by boat in Lower Manhattan after spending weeks and weeks coming from Mexico via Cuba on a boat that looked just like this one. It was actually the Morro Castle Line, and came to Lower Manhattan, and it was his... He was invited here, of course, by the director of the museum, Alfred Barr, to do a show here. So it was pretty... He was already, at that point, really one of the most famous artists in the world. He was written about at the time as being the most talked about artist on this side of the Atlantic. He was so famous, in fact, that the captain of the ship turned over part of his own personal quarters on the ship to Rivera so that he could furiously work on paintings that as he was getting ready for his show here. And he arrived a month ahead of when the show was slated to open. And why? Well, because to choose Diego Rivera as a subject for a show, to choose his work, is to choose someone who's famous as, of course, a muralist. And that creates a paradox. How does a museum like MoMA show the work of a muralist? They can't chop down the walls and send the wonderful hundreds of murals that he had done in Mexico City up to New York. So what were they going to do? So a compromise, a solution was reached, whereby Rivera would create murals on the spot in the monthly, made to order, essentially, art made to order, the month before the show. And he was asked to do 7. In typical Rivera style, he did 8. He always did more than he was asked. In Detroit, he was only going to do a wall, but of course he convinced them to give them the whole courtyard. And so he made 8 murals on the spot, 5 which were based on murals he's already done in Mexico City, and then 3 which were New York scenes that he added to the show after it opened. So he arrives on this boat, greeted. It's a pretty auspicious moment, and he's greeted by Alfred Barr, the director, the young director of the museum, who he'd already met in Russia, Jer Abbott, who is also high up in the museum, and the president of MoMA. And with him on the boat was Frida Kahlo, who was helping him, really acting at that point more as a wife than as an artist, although she'd obviously begun her career. And he also brought with him one of his most trusted assistants, and he was greeted by an assistant who had worked with him in San Francisco. So this was quite the entourage, I have to say, when he made it to New York. And here you see him in the studio that MoMA had paid for in that month, that furious month that he had to create work leading up to the show. And there you see him creating a work that I'll show you a color image of that's now in the Philadelphia Museum. And at that moment, MoMA was in its first building on 57th and 5th, I think it was, where I get my hair cut, actually. I need to, try to get on the wrong floor and try to see where he actually would have had his studios. So he was literally working above the galleries in his own studio in the winter, trying to get these murals done. And what you'll see, this is the one that we have on view, and this is the only one that we kept and remains in our collection. This is an image of the agrarian leader Zapata, the really kind of the Che Guevara of his day, the martyr of the Mexican Revolution, who had died by the end of the revolution and who was so glorified by Mexicans, and it's still to this day, if you go to Mexico City, Zapata's name is absolutely everywhere. But I think, stepping back for a moment, I think we have to ask a couple of questions that I think are quite fascinating. One is, why did MoMA choose Rivera? Why was North America so captivated by this man that he was the most talked? I mean, you had Picasso in Europe and Rivera on the Western Hemisphere. I mean, you had him on the Western side of the Atlantic. It really was that level of fame. And then, so why did MoMA choose Rivera, especially an avowed communist? That's, I think, a really, really important question. And then why does he continue to be patronized by the leading capitalist titans of our country? We're not just talking about the Rockefeller family, but then the Ford family. I mean, it doesn't get more capitalist than that. I think is a question we have to ask ourselves. And MoMA, Manhattan, the epicenter of capitalism. And then the other question is that I think we have to ask ourselves is why was Rivera interested in being here as well? That's a little bit easier to answer because murals paid very, very little. He could barely survive in spite of the fact that he was the most prolific and productive of the muralists. Actually, he could barely survive on what he was making for the murals. They really almost served more as you know, it was public art that he was sharing with the public. He was paid very little for them. So that was part of why he came here. He also came here because he really believed that socialism and proletarian unity combined with technology and modern industry was the way of the future. And America thrilled him for its embrace of industry and technology. And that's one of the reasons he and Ford got along so smashingly, is he genuinely really, really was fascinated by industry and felt that that combined with socialist ideals was the way of the future. So America appealed to him. Its racial diversity also appealed to him. But again, why was North America interested in him? And I have a couple of answers to throw out there. A, he had recently broken with the Communist Party. He kind of did this back and forth with the Communist Party the same way he did with Frida. You know, he was going in and out of favor all the time. You can't even keep track of when he's a member. It's like so constant. So we happen to catch him. MoMA happens to catch him right when he's, you know, not a full-fledged communist. Also, keep in mind, we look at communism now through the lens of the Cold War and McCarthyism. It really isn't, in the 1930s, communism was not quite the stigma that it is today. And really, there were so many artists who were interested in communism. Capitalism seemed to have failed. Look at the Great Depression. So I think it's important to understand that while Rockefeller maybe was obviously not a communist sympathizer, that the country was much more open to it. Also keep in mind, there's a bit of a cultural diplomacy going on here. And this is an area of research that I think needs to be looked into more. But in the midst of a depression, people who create art for the people, about the people, that becomes popular. That becomes people in power are also using that in a bit as propaganda in their own way as well. So this was an interesting and complex relationship. And also keep in mind that Rivera was smart and charming and captivating, and he'd already captured the world's imagination, so it's no surprise that people wanted him to bring people into the doors. And so this mural is interesting because you can see that while it's painted, he had one thing to understand is that Rivera really had spent 10 entire years in Europe. So really, Rivera is so steeped in Italian fresco traditions. He spent 17 months in Italy looking at Italian frescoes. So he was incredibly well-versed. And so this is one of the portable murals that he created as a solution for the MoMA retrospective. It's like 6 by 8 feet or so. And I think it's a really beautiful composition. It's kind of Rivera's almost our American, and I say American in the broad sense, our American Uccello or Giotto. You know, these are really absolutely exquisitely, beautifully composed. It almost glows. The light, the color is wonderful. Really amazing compositions. And of course, what's radical about Rivera is not his style. His style is actually very old-fashioned. There's nothing radical, in my opinion, about his technique or his style. What's radical about the work is that he is taking mural, a medium that is associated with royalty, with princes, with religious figures, with Christ, and he's using that to celebrate peasants, ordinary people, indigenous people, and so that's really that's the kernel of what makes Rivera, I think, a radical and at this moment in time a very modern artist. But I would also say that these panels were a failure. If you look at these, this is one in the Philadelphia Museum, also on view right now. These are, again, the Mexican themes. They're a failure because at their heart, he was trying to create portable murals. And what's so sad is that the show traveled to the Philadelphia Museum, and I think it's this one, or maybe it was one of the other ones, only one of the 8 murals actually went with the show. They couldn't even travel as far as Philadelphia the year they were made. So they're a complete failure in a practical sense. And why is that? It's because they weighed so much. Each one of them weighs, like 1,000 pounds or so. If you go up into our galleries, you'll see it. There's like a ledge underneath our mural, and there's steel underneath that supporting our mural, and we had to get, it was complicated to install. So, and the surface is quite fragile. So while murals are very durable medium out when they are in situ and they're not portable, they withstand sunlight a lot better than a painting would. They're sort of on rock. They feel like rock. If you were to touch one, it feels like stone. But on the other hand, it's just burdensome and tricky and heavy to carry and awkward. So sadly, a failure in that front. And as I'm teaching a Mexican mural modernism class right now, and one of my students also, I think, made a really good point last night and said, also, why make these as portable murals? Why not just make these as canvases? What about these, you know, why make this in this medium? Because in essence, a mural, what is special about a mural is that it is in a public space and that it has this relationship with architecture and relationship with that space, and it is available to a wider audience than, say, a museum. So why create a portable mural? What advantage does it even offer you? I mean, it offers you the advantage that you're famous as a muralist, so of course people want to see your murals. But, you know, I think that was a really good point. Why not make this on canvas? What makes this really such a mural? And the critics picked up on that. The show was a sweeping success for the public. It was extended. It broke all attendance records. He blew Henri Matisse out of the water. But critically, he was being criticized for that. And the other thing is, these are excerpts of larger murals he made in Mexico. All of these, if you've been to Mexico City, you could recognize every single one. It's a slight adaptation or excerpt from the one that we own is from Cuernavaca, if you've been to Cuernavaca, you know, and they're in various places. In terms of controversy, were any of these controversial? Mexican-themed ones, not so much. This is an ancient scene of an Aztec dressed as a jaguar, and even though it's called Night of the Tiger, dressed as a jaguar, they just got their iconography confused, but slaying a conquistador. So these were not so controversial, but and even here, this is sort of a universal scene in some ways. But the New York panels became a bit more controversial in the press, because what he does is, you know, we're in the midst of the Depression, and he is depicting. Well, here I think this one seems pretty innocent enough. It's electric welding. You see his love of labor, his love of industry, and you can see the Manhattan skyline in the back. So this one didn't cause any. This is really an homage to labor, and this one didn't either. This one's a lost panel. We don't know where it is. So all I have here is the sketch. Fascinatingly enough, these are drillers creating Rockefeller Center. So he has no idea he's going to be commissioned to create a mural there. But there they are at work creating the biggest building of the Depression. But this is the one that became controversial, and it's in a Mexico City collection. Because here what he's done is he's... let's move for a moment. And this very interesting composition, it's this tripartite composition, and he's literally showing the stratification of New York. You know, that's one of the things that Frida and Diego both commented on, was the incredible disparities in wealth. And so here you have all of these skyscrapers, but these cranes that are sort of sitting idle because not much is happening. And this to me looks like a morgue, but if you look at it closely and if you read about it, it's actually essentially a center for homeless people and people who are dispossessed and displaced or who don't have anywhere to go during the day because they don't have jobs. So this is actually a bunch of, these are people lined up sleeping. And this is someone, of course, guarding them or sort of keeping an eye. But it has this feeling of a prison. It feels very oppressive. And this is, of course, the most pointed part. And I'm sorry this reproduction isn't great, but what you're seeing here is a woman checking on her jewels at a bank vault. So, I mean, this is... Diego Rivera is not exactly known for his subtlety. he had to leave that to Orozco. But you know, he was an amazing storyteller. And you could always get his point. I mean, part of what murals were intended for was to educate and instill pride in Mexican audiences, the ones made in Mexico. I don't think this is trying to instill any pride. I think this is trying to instill shame, actually. It was always clear what he was trying to inculcate in us. But this one did generate a little bit of controversy, but not enough to you know, change anything that was going to happen, say, for example, in Detroit, where he had already planned to have a big project. So I'm just going to skip over Detroit because it's not New York, but I did want to say that this was an enormous success. This is sort of the magnum opus that he, this whole courtyard that he made for Ford, that Edsel Ford, while not directly, he wasn't the museum director, William Valentiner, who you see there in profile, was the museum director, but Ford really bankrolled the whole thing. And if you have a chance to ever see this mural in Detroit, you should. So just to give you a little chronology, Detroit's between the MoMA retrospective and Rockefeller Center. And then Rockefeller Center, I mean, we could spend a whole session on just that, but I'm going to try to do this as briefly as I can so we can move on to Frida Kahlo. But basically, you know, he had been invited to create a mural at in this new building that was 70 stories building in the middle of the Depression. And the architect was a man named Raymond Hood. He was one of the architects involved who came out to Detroit to, like, look at Rivera's sketches, Rivera's sketching for Rockefeller Center in Detroit. You might be familiar with the Radiator Building, which is one of Hood's other buildings in the city. And really, this is a exciting moment for Rivera. You know, he's getting one major commission after the next. He's already got one lined up potentially for the Chicago's World's Fair. And but keep in mind the moment. We're in the midst of the Deep Depression, very important to the story. And also that the day that they arrive, Kahlo and Rivera arrive in March, I think it was March 20th, in New York from Detroit. It's the day that Dachau, in the concentration camp, first concentration camp in Europe, is open. Hitler is rising to power this year. It's a pretty intense moment. And he's been given a title. He's been told what he's supposed to depict, and it's Man at the Crossroads. I can never remember the exact title. It's the longest title ever. It's like Man at the Crossroads looking for a bright and promising future. So he's supposed to be depicting Man at the Crossroads at this difficult time, looking towards the future. And he talks about how it's going to show the workers inheriting of the cities and the country inheriting the earth. But of course, he has all these figures in the composition, but it's more about workers and ordinary people. And it was not at the beginning his sketches that were approved by the Rockefeller family, because it's Nelson Rockefeller who's behind all of this, and Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, his mother, who are really running the show. His sketches never included Lenin, but this, as you may know, what happens is in the middle of the project, he inserts Lenin at the center of the mural. And, you know, there's the nicest letter that Nelson Rockefeller writes Rivera saying, I am so impressed by this mural, and I think it's wonderful, and I hate to ask you to change anything because I respect you so much. But, you know, Lenin wasn't in our original sketches, and put yourself in my position. This is a building we are building in the midst of the Depression, and I think having Lenin be the first face you see when you walk through the door might, you know, it will be very difficult for us to, you know, sell any of the spaces in this building, essentially. And he just kindly asks him to replace him with someone else. So, I mean, it's an interesting dilemma. On one hand, obviously, none of us are big fans of censorship, or at least I hope none of us in the room are big pro-censorship people. On the other hand, I have to say I pretty much feel for Nelson Rockefeller. I mean, he's the pay and the money. He commissioned Rivera to do this, and, you know, I honestly feel like this is, in some ways, even as a Rivera fan, I understand their position. I understand that this, you know, maybe they could have negotiated better, but, you know, a mural with Lenin in the center of it, yeah, in the middle of the Depression, I could see how that might be a bit of a problem. As one art historian hilariously dubbed it impropaganda instead of propaganda, I love that. Why was he so tough? Why did he hold out? Why would he not back down? Well, first of all of his assistants were totally committed, passionate. Ben Shawn, if you're familiar with the American artist, was like, don't back down, don't back down. Ben Shawn was assisting him on the project. And don't forget that at this moment, he's back in the Communist Party's good graces, and everyone in Mexico is criticizing him. He is coming under enormous attack, because what has he just done? He's just created one of the greatest murals for Edsel Ford. You know, another leading capitalist. So Siqueiros, the fellow Mexican artist, has basically branded him the court painter to the American capitalist elite. That is not the reputation that Rivera is seeking. So this is the most politically charged of all of the murals he ever created. You know, there was a little controversy about Detroit, but it had to do with the nativity scene and, you know, with science and religion being mixed improperly. It was kind of, it died down. You know, this is a much more incendiary, much more brazen. And I do think he's being more brazen because at that point, his artistic reputation is solidified, and he cares more about his political reputation and what he stands for. So the work is eventually demolished, and it's sad. I think I've read that there were potential negotiations for it to come to MoMA. It's so sad that it didn't. But I don't know exactly why that never worked out. But it was pretty much just destroyed. And what he did with but but Rockefellers, you know, they were good to their name, and they gave him all of his money. They whitewashed it, but they gave him his $14,000. And what he did is he took that money and he used it, and he used it to create a mural for the workers, for the people. And so he basically spent almost all that money on making a new mural. And what he did is you're seeing here images of that. It's at the New Worker School. It's a little confusing. This is not the new school. The New Worker School doesn't exist anymore, but it happens to be like two blocks from where the new school is now. So it gets a little confusing. But basically, there was a school on 14th Street that was created by the founder of the Communist Party in the United States, a man named Jay Lovestone. The school was created by him, and Bertram Wolf, his biographer, Rivera's biographer. Rivera was enough of a celebrity. He had a biography produced in his own lifetime. And so his biographer was running the school. And he decides that since this is a school for workers, that he's going to create a mural for the people. And what he does, very much in the spirit of MoMA, he creates 21 portable murals, which is good because the school's defunct in like 3 years, and so the portable murals were needed. Unfortunately, they were sent off to Pennsylvania, and most of them were destroyed in a fire. So they're dispersed now, which means, you know, the whole point of a mural is not to have it be dispersed. But anyway, the portable mural is deeply problematic, and there is a new book on it that I am in the middle of reading, Muralism Without Walls, if any of you are interested, but that just came out. But anyway, he creates this mural, and it's called Portrait of America, and it just sort of takes you through an American history. It includes people like Ben Franklin and Abraham Lincoln. It shows people like Mussolini and Hitler as evil. I mean, it's very didactic. Mussolini, Hitler, evil. Lenin, good. You know, that kind of thing. Rosa Luxemburg, good. But it's a very, I should say, he was an anti-Stalinist. He's a communist, but he's absolutely anti-Stalinist. They realize that he's a brutal dictator. They don't quite realize, they've got a slightly overly nostalgic feelings for Lenin because they haven't quite figured out all the horrible things that he had also done. But he worked on this for 5 months and then essentially plunged into a deep depression because you know, he had lost the Chicago World's Fair Commission, and he was really, it was an exhausting experience, both physically and emotionally. So we're going to leave Rivera leaving Manhattan on a very sour note, obviously. And there's Mussolini on the left. This is the mural. It's also incredibly dense. It's just like unbelievable. That was sort of a characteristic of Rivera's work. Let's move on to Frida. So if Rivera was excited about Manhattan, excited about the economic opportunities, thrilled about the modern industry, Kahlo was much more disdainful. She was not interested in New York. She thought it was frigid. She hated being there. She thought the people were mean. She called the United States Gringolandia, and she disdained it. She really just disdained it, although she did love Chinatown. She thought that was the greatest thing ever. Cheap dime stores and Marx movies. Those were her saving graces. And so really when she first comes to New York was with Rivera while he's working on the show at MoMA, and then she comes back when he's doing the Rockefeller Center murals. So you see her there, Rockefeller and New Worker School. But during the more than 8 months that she was there in 1933, she only produced one work, which I want to show you this one first just because it's one of the few images that very directly engages the United States. And I think you can see what I'm talking about in terms of her negative view of New York. Although it's actually a little bit more ambiguous here, perhaps. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting about Kahlo's work is she always creates these dualities. And you see her holding the Mexican flag in one hand and a cigarette in the other. You know, that's America and this is Mexico, I guess. But things have changed. But then you see this side, the sort of fertility of ancient Mexico. You see wonderful ruins. You see literally flowers growing, the sense of a fertile soil. And then she contrasts that with, I think it's a megaphone and all these various appliances. The cords literally are sort of echoing the roots of the plant. So it's like America's got industry, Mexico's got sort of wonderful agrarian bounty. And I love what she does here with sort of these skyscrapers and smokestacks, which, by the way, say Ford.
F-O-R-D. You can barely see that, F-O-R-D. And she's got, of course, the sun and the moon, and this is sort of nature and industry at its most simplistic, nature and industry. And she's herself at the crossroads on this column, kind of between these two worlds. So the whole notion of border and being in between two worlds, and then you see the American flag consumed not by natural clouds, but by, smoke coming from these smokestacks. But fascinating painting in some ways because it's in America, it's in Detroit, that she starts making paintings on metal. We have one in our collection upstairs right now, tiny. It's one of my favorite paintings that she's ever made. It's Rivera who says, since she worked, they were such opposites. She was the dove and he was the elephant. He was larger than life, quite literally, 300 pounds. She was tiny. He worked on this massive public scale, and she worked in a very sort of intimate scale. And because of that, Rivera said, "Well, why don't you try working on metal?" Because she was obsessed with retablos, Mexican retablos, those wonderful small paintings. I grew up with my mom; always collected them. And they are to thank they're to thank Christ or to thank a saint for performing some sort of miracle. So this is if Rivera's cue is the fresco or the mural and source of inspiration, Kahlo's is really this small retablo painting tradition. But look at how much more negative it gets when she does this incredible, also very small work called "My Dress Hangs There." This is begun in New York. It's the only painting that she does in the 8 months while Rivera's working on Rockefeller Center and the New Workers School. And look at how much more negative this is at this point. She's been replaced by just her dress. That sense of loss, that emptiness, there's nobody even inhabiting the body. It hung almost like it's on a clothesline or something. And then look at how America's being represented. Not so favorably, I'd argue. Not so favorably. I mean, I know it's hard to see all the details in here, but let me walk you through. It's not a rosy picture. First of all, we're being represented by a toilet. I mean, arguably, some would say this is a lovely thing because we're amazing with our hygiene, right? But, it's not exactly the thing you'd want to put on a column, per se. This poster of Mae West is peeling. It sort of seems tawdry. You can't maybe see this that well. It's a cross and a dollar sign in the church. I mean, that's pretty unsubtle. And then you've got, I love the sort of smokestacks and the way that there's almost become these anthropomorphic or these become these machine, robotic machines or industry, but also still look sort of human, like we've turned into robots. And of course, we don't see any people too, and it's such a compressed, tight space. Everything is, pressed up. And that's the way I feel sometimes living in New York, like everything feels so tight and so compressed. And then I think the part for me, and she also has the federal building with like stock exchange. This is a collage. It's the only collage we know that she ever made. But she collages sort of stock exchange records of sort of how the economy is doing in the 30s and 40s. You've got this heap of garbage, too. Also something I think kind of still classically New York. I don't know. I mean, when I first moved here, I was like, why are there so many trash bags everywhere? So I think that might have been the case for a very long time. But I think the part that's the most disturbing for me, aside from the empty dress and the little fire on the left, is actually the telephone wire. This telephone here, it appears that all these crazy black lines that you see running through these vacant buildings is telephone wire. And to me, it's very disturbing. It's the way it winds through is off-putting and sort of anxious, I think. And she, one of the things I'd love at some point to write about is the way she uses cords and ribbons. She's always using these things in very interesting ways, very loaded ways. And then I should mention that all of these collaged elements along the bottom of the masses of people, they're almost all from protests, racial protests, people protesting, being African Americans protesting brutal treatment. They're all from various protests, which is kind of interesting as well. So I think we see a pretty grim view of New York here, and I just want to show you a better view. Although she did like it better than Detroit in the end. But New York was good to her in one key way, I think. In 1938, she is invited by Julian Levy, one of the leading Manhattan gallerists, to have a solo show at his gallery on 57th Street. Now, Julian Levy was someone who
introduced Alberto Giacometti to this country. First show of Giacometti ever, that was Julian Levy. First show of Lee Miller, the photographer, Julian Levy. First show of Salvador Dali, Julian Levy. First show of Joseph Cornell, Julian Levy. I mean, I could just keep going and going and going. So he was especially associated with Surrealists, but also a number of important women artists who were outside the Surrealist vein. And to host her show, I mean, it's interesting that he puts Frida Rivera in parentheses. I mean, she's still seen as Diego Rivera's wife. But she comes to New York on her own, leaves him behind. They're not doing so well in their relationship at this point. And even though it's still the Depression, the show is an incredible success. Georgia O'Keeffe, who briefly she had an affair with. Georgia O'Keeffe, Osamu Noguchi, other prominent American artists were all at the opening. Approximately half of the paintings were sold, which for 1938, I think is quite an accomplishment. And the show was very well received by the press, even if their praise betrayed their sexism. Time magazine raved about Little Frida's pictures. So I think it was a big success for her. And here's these are kind of these amazing photos that Julian Levy took. They briefly had a sort of a dalliance together. He took these incredible photos of her, only nude photos that I think we have of her. He talked about how the way she prepared her hair was like liturgy. It was just such an amazing thing to observe. This is one of the paintings that's in that show and that we have on view upstairs. It's one of the ones that's on metal. And this is one of my favorite paintings in our collection. I'm going to have to do the brief treatment of it since I want to leave some time for questions, but go see it in person. I mean, first of all, this is Little Frida's pictures and always being described as charming. I beg to differ. I think she's quite fearless. You can be charmed by them, but they're quite fearless. I mean, how many people do you know that would show in their family tree the sperm and the egg coming together? Only Frida Kahlo, especially in the 1930s, pretty amazing. Sperm and egg, she shows herself in utero. I mean, that's remarkable. These are her parents, taken from a wedding photograph. Her father was an accomplished photographer. And I think one of the reasons, even though she's self-taught, that she had a real attention to detail was because she was very close to him. And there you see her as a child, literally inside of her, you know, home, the blue house, the Casa Azul that she grew up in. And interestingly, the leg that was deformed from polio as a child is like sort of hidden by this tree. Everything about this painting you could spend an hour thinking about. And of course, I mentioned how much I love the way ribbons and cords are used in her painting. And here she's got this ribbon that essentially becomes like a bloodline. And then echoes the sort of umbilical cord. I mean, it's really quite interesting. But what I think I find most extraordinary about this painting, especially for one so small, is I see it as a political document. It is a very much politically brazen document. And why is that? Well, this is 1936. The Nuremberg Laws have just been passed in Nazi Germany. And if you aren't aware of this, Frida Kahlo was partially German and partially Jewish, actually. Although technically not Jewish because her mother's side of the family was deeply Catholic. So her mother's side of the family, if you look on the upper left, there are a combination of indigenous Mexican and European mestizo, mixed Mexican and European. And you can see that even just looking at her family. Father's side of the family, and look at that walrus facial hair. I mean, that doesn't look so Mexican, does it? I mean, father's side of the family is distinctively German. And she grew up going to a German high school. She spoke fluent German. She read fluent. I mean, she was very well read. She read French, read and spoke French, Spanish, and German, and some English. So really quite impressive. And what I think is interesting about this painting is that she is essentially at the moment of the Nazi rise to power, where the politics of racial purity is being espoused as law, not just as politics, as law. She is creating a painting that celebrates her mixed heritage, and there is no way that you can miss that. She is showing that she has not only German and European and Native Mexican heritage, but that she also even has Jewish heritage. And in fact, there's a scholar who's done a ton of research on this specific painting that that says that this is not a traditional family tree. The sort of these red lines are actually, she thinks, adopted from the Nuremberg charts that the Nazis were using to pass their laws. So there's a fascinating, you can find this, I think, if you Google the Jewish Museum in Frida Kahlo. There's a bunch of information about this. But she had Jewish ancestry. She'd often sign her paintings, go upstairs into her gallery. She'd sometimes sign her name, her signature, F-R-I-E-D-A, Frida, to assert her Germanness, to make people remember that she had that heritage. So I think that this is really a political document, and that Frida is not just a charming artist, but someone who really packs a punch. This is a work that sells from the show. That's wonderful. Sells to the Louvre, somehow makes it to the Pompidou. I haven't researched that, but that's kind of interesting. And then I wanted to end, just since I want to have a few minutes for questions, really quickly, just to tell you the story behind this painting that's on view upstairs. One of the paintings that sold in the show to a dear friend of Kahlo's, she was so delighted that her friend bought the painting that she gave her this painting as a gift. And the part that was included in the Levy show was just the painting on the left. She adds the mural when she gives it to her friend, saying, "This way we can always be together." That you could look, she would look in the mirror and she'd see Frida just by her side. I talk about this painting in a blog that I wrote for the museum. And so if you have a chance and want to read more, there's also a long label about it. But it's really an amazing painting. It's kind of I think of it as a Madonna and Child painting, but she's substituted the monkey that she had as a pet, the sort of surrogate. But there's also some humor in here. I mean, Frida's work is political, but it is also has wit in it. How many artists do you know that would emphasize how their facial features resemble a monkey's? You know, the monobrow. She even shows hair along the side of her face. I mean, she really goes to great effort to make her mustache show up more in this painting. It's I think, quite funny. I mean, look at those hairy cacti that surround her. Pretty amazing. Not there for no reason. And I think she's also influenced by a wonderful artist, Rousseau. This has become a very favorite, beloved picture for Facebook profiles. And although I'll admit I conned this woman into posing there for my blog. And then just skipping ahead, this is another work that was in the show, very disturbing, called What the Water Gave Me. You can see her parents here, that same, but people drowning. This is a pretty fascinating image. And then the last thing I wanted to show you is one of the commissions she gets from the show. The managing editor of Vanity Fair, a woman named Claire Luce, commissions her to paint a portrait of her recently deceased friend. I don't think she had any idea that Frida would depict her as she plunges to her suicide. That was not what she had in mind. She said she nearly passed out when she saw the painting. She felt a tremendous sense of guilt. She had lent her friend money. Her friend had just been divorced. She was a socialite, a really prominent New Yorker, a woman named Dorothy Hale. The plays have been written about her. And Claire Luce, this editor, had lent her money because she had recently gotten divorced, and she had lived this extravagant life, but she had no funds whatsoever. She couldn't even pay her rent. And a suitor of hers, a male suitor, says, "You just need to marry someone rich, so go out and buy a nice dress." And so she goes out and buys a nice dress and commits suicide in it. And so it's a quite sordid, complex tale. It's pretty, I mean, this is, again, not a charming artist. To be commissioned to create a work and to create this, I think, is about as fearless as you get. So on that note, oh, and there's the retablo that I think is in her collection. You can see the influence in the text on the bottom. I want to give us a few moments for questions, so I'm going to end there, but hopefully I've convinced you that at the very least, while a complex relationship with Manhattan, a pretty fascinating one, and certainly crucial to the story of Mexican modern art. So thank you so much. Thank you. Does anyone have any questions? I'm happy to entertain any of them. Yeah.
Were the paternal grandparents both Jewish?
Paternal. I think only one of them was. I think only the mother. I have to double check that again. But yes, it wasn't so much. She wouldn't have been like traditionally Jewish in the true sense, I think. Obviously, since her mother wasn't even Jewish. But the point being that she identified with her Jewish relatives, and she doesn't hide it at a moment when, you know, any kind of Jewish ancestry whatsoever. Would, by the Nazis' estimation, she would be Jewish, you know, but not by traditional Jewish faith. Yeah.
Do you know what that building is? In
the- it's the Hampshire Building, I think, somewhere in Midtown. I forget. It sounds familiar. I can't quite remember. Somewhere in Midtown, but it is the building where she committed, where she did commit suicide. She basically held a party for herself and invited people over and sort of said goodbye, but they didn't realize it was a final goodbye. Yeah.
The painting on metal.
Yeah.
One was zinc, one was metal. Was that something that she kept doing, or did she just do that for the, when she was in the United States?
No, she kept doing that. It became very important to her. It was something that she really enjoyed. And you'll see other paintings that she did in continuation.
Do you know what percentage of her paintings were on
metal? I don't offhand. But, you know, keep in mind that she only made about 150 paintings in her lifetime. That's the same number of paintings Rivera had in his show at MoMA when he was in the early parts of his career. And why? Part of it's that she's acting as a wife a lot of the time. I mean, he's on the scaffolding like 24 hours a day and constantly needs attention and help. But it's also because she didn't have the opportunities. She didn't think she could become, you know, people always referred to it somewhat dismissively. So I don't think she, even though she was certainly ambitious but I don't think she had the same level of opportunity or the mindset that she could do as much. And also, she was ill a lot of the time. She was constantly, I mean, the number of surgeries, I can't remember how many surgeries she had in her life, but it was outrageous. And the fact that she even lasted as long as she did is really amazing. So that certainly interfered. Yeah.
Speaking of surgeries, I understand that many of those surgeries were needless surgeries, and there may have been a manipulation for attention from Diego Rivera because he was most solicitous when she was recuperating or something.
I don't know. I doubt that because I, you know, having been through very few surgeries, knock on wood, in my life, I just can't fathom some of the things that she had to go through doing that needlessly. And it didn't seem to, if that would have worked, it would have worked a lot, it should have worked a lot better. I mean, you're talking about a person who had like 75 surgeries. I mean, that if your husband's going to have a little more pity on you, you would have thought 50, 75 surgeries later, something would have happened. I think the relationship was just complicated and turbulent and that, you know, I mean, the biography is fascinating. But I think that, I don't think that the surgeries for the, as far as I'm aware, that they were needless. Medicine was different, obviously, so maybe there were some misunderstandings about what to do and the right things to do, but I don't think that they were needless, everyone I've read about. Yeah?
There was recently a story about a painting, they're not sure if it was hers, where she's holding both of her arms detached from her shoulders. Would you know anything about that?
No, that's funny. I remember there was a big, pretty big scandal recently about some ephemera and letters and things that, diaries and stuff that somebody found and published a whole book on. I think it was published by Princeton Press. And, okay. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. My guess, I don't actually know that much about that particular work, but Frida's work doesn't come on the market very often, so when a new Frida Kahlo is discovered, we should all be skeptical. They wish that those works came on the market, but they really don't. There aren't that many. So, be skeptical. Yeah, did you have a question?
What was the crown on that Christ head there?
Oh,
like
yeah.
Chicken feet or something?
Yeah, gosh. I don't know. That's a good point. It does look like, it does actually look like chicken feet, and that's quite disturbing. But one of the things that's interesting about this, that I'm glad you asked this question, because one of the things that's interesting about Mexican art and culture is the sort of more open attitude towards death, and just, there's a way in which I think, the sort of intensity of her work, sometimes she would show blood, she'd show a woman committing suicide. In Mexico, there's just much more of a tradition of life and death coexisting, and not quite the puritanical North American, you know, fear of and denial of that. And she was so open. I mean, she has this amazing painting called My Birth, where she shows herself being born. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's not an angelic, you know, post-operating table mother holding child thing. It is really intense. There's such an honesty in her work. Anyone else? Yeah.
First of all, your lecture was really terrific. When you were talking about...
Thanks.
When you were talking, or wondering, kind of rhetorically, why Rivera didn't paint his portable murals on canvas rather than the big, heavy things, I think, you would know better than I, but I think the technique involved in painting on plaster was entirely different from
absolutely
the technique that would be used on canvas, and that, since he had studied fresco painting and all that, I mean, it's, maybe it couldn't translate so well.
But he made a lot of canvases as well, even though early on in his career, all the Mexican modernists said, like, we repudiate easel painting, it's elitist, but they all made tons of easel paintings. So my question is really, like, I know why he made murals. It's partially because that's what the public wanted, but did it really make sense to make them portable? And this book is, I'm only halfway through it, but I think her conclusion is, you know, it's very flawed. You know, and why not make a canvas instead then? What about it as a mural if it's all disassembled and it separates? Like, what connection does it have to the architecture? I mean, part of it is that in New York, architecture, buildings rise and fall, especially during the Depression. So I understand it was a practical solution. I just don't know that it was the most successful one. They look different, though. If you go upstairs, we've got a canvas of Rivera next to the mural. And look at them closely without touching them. Look at them closely. You'll see very different color. The mural's much more muted. There's a different quality of light. I mean, they look different. There are advantages to doing mural, but I'd argue the biggest advantage is when it occupies a public space, and that is just inherently the problem of portable murals. Yeah.
I would just recommend anyone, if you get to go to Mexico City, the public education building, which you can visit, has over 60 of his murals. It's three floors. It's all outdoor but covered. That's amazing.
Yeah. Over 100, actually. That was really what cemented. That's when Rivera becomes Rivera, and that's what cements him. People were going to watch him paint the way they would go to an ancient ruin. I mean, that's how this is where his reputation really came from. And actually, at Rockefeller Center, I forgot to mention, they were issuing tickets. I mean, these architects were not dumb. They didn't like Lenin, but they knew he would generate some wonderful publicity and then some very bad publicity. But they were issuing tickets for people to watch him. So that's pretty fascinating.
How old was Nelson Rockefeller then?
Pretty young. I forget how old, but I'm guessing in his 30s, maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
As I was listening to you and from things I've read, there seemed to be a dichotomy with Rivera between, I think he thought, he probably loved the theory of communism, but within his life, he seemed to want to live well, enjoy some of the material things that capitalism offered.
Yeah, and thanks for mentioning that, because I didn't get a chance to talk about his last mural in the United States. He comes back to San Francisco in the, there's a Golden Gate International Exposition in Treasure Island, if any of you have been to the Bay Area. Treasure Island was built for this show, and he is commissioned to create a huge mural, and I'm sorry I don't have a good color image of it. But he creates, at this point in his life, he is so disenchanted with fascism and even with communism, and he's really hopes for North and South America and Latin America to all be sort of a unified whole. It's a really interesting mural where his thoughts have really evolved, and if any of you ever are in San Francisco, it's a bit of a trek to get there. It's at City College, but I think it's one of the most interesting murals he ever made. He was also obsessed with Charlie Chaplin and The Great Dictator, and he shows Hitler, and then he shows Charlie Chaplin as Hitler. Meanwhile, he's having an affair with Paulette Goddard, who's Chaplin's wife. I mean, it's the most insane mural. The librarians there have spent their lives working on this mural. They have a whole room dedicated to it, and it's really interesting. So that's sort of his last gasp. And then World War II happens, and muralism really goes by the wayside. It drops out of favor, and you see the rise of people who are abstract art really takes over. And he's really, all these murals that are portable, they're all kept in storage until he dies. You know, they're just not even seen. So really falls from favor after the 1940s. But you should all probably want to go, so let me let you go. And if anyone else has questions, you can feel free to ask me them up here. Thanks so much.